Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast special. Ooh. Another special today, which is very exciting. Today we're going to be speaking to Roman Krasnarek. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I might have pronounced it wrong, but we'll find out a little bit later. He's going to be talking to us about his book, Carpe Diem Regained, The Vanishing Art of Seizing the Day. And I've read it. It's basically a book... It's all about how we as humans, we learn how to seize the day, and then it's been hijacked by sort of those marketing type people and stuff and other people in society. And he wants us to regain it for ourselves. He's going to teach us how to live our lives, Mark. So if you're sitting there, and you're at home and you're or wherever you are and you're listening to the podcast, you're thinking, am I living my life correctly?
You're asking him to do a lot.
No.
in what, an hour or whatever we do. Yeah.
He's going to teach us how to live our life. You're not a Carpe Diem man, are you? You're not a Seize the Day man? Or are you?
How dare you?
I don't see you as a Seize the Day man. Actually, that's really unfair of me to say. Are you a Carpe Diem man?
I'd like to think I am.
Give me seven.
No, I'm not going to sit
give me
here and...
seven examples.
No.
Give me one example.
No.
Right, let me think. Carpe diem. When did I seize the day last? I'll have a little think about that. Well, I don't have a lot of routine. You don't have a lot of routine, do you? Your job chops and changes.
I'm always
really.
Seizing the day. I'm always coming up with an idea, pitching it to someone, having to go and meet them with a ridiculous idea they might not like.
Touched a nerve here, haven't I?
No, I'm
offended?
No, I'm not offended because that, you know... Let's get on with the podcast.
Okay, let's speak to him. He's a lovely bloke. Also, his job, which is really exciting, is a social philosopher. Don't really know what that means.
Well,
so
you should ask him. Seize the day, Tim, and ask him.
Let's find out.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does... Right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to the podcast, Roman Krasnarek. Have I said that all right?
You said it perfectly. Oh, better than me.
Beautiful. So in a minute, you're going to teach us how to live our lives properly. True? No pressure.
That's quite a tall order, but yeah. I've written a book about it. That's as good as I can do.
You're going to give us you've just mentioned let's still talk about your job first of all. You're a social philosopher. What does that mean?
It's a bit of a weird title, and I've invented it myself. And if you go into my study where I live in Oxford, there are two circles drawn on the board which are overlapping. And one circle says the art of living, and the other one says social change. And I try and do all my thinking and writing and talking in that space where they overlap. In other words, I'm interested in ideas which can help us in everyday life, but which can also maybe change society in some ways. So I've written a book about empathy, and that's all about how you can step into somebody else's shoes. That can help your relationships with your family, but it's also how you can step into the shoes of people who are different from you.
Yeah, I've read your book on empathy, and I've interviewed on it, and it's very good. I like that a lot. You've just done a talk on the history of love. You've just literally arrived here after doing that. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think the way we think about love today is probably the great tragedy in the history of the emotions. I mean, if you walk into a cafe and you ask for a coffee, there's lots of different coffees you can ask for, right? You can have a cappuccino or a flat white or a double espresso, but we're not nearly as sophisticated in the way we talk about love. We have this one word, love, to cover all sorts of different aspects of relationships. And what I was talking about this morning was the different varieties of love that the ancient Greeks had. You might think like, okay, well, how relevant the ancient Greeks to our lives 2,500 years later? But I think they're incredibly relevant. So one of the words they had for love was Eros, which was their word for sexual passion and desire. We all know about that. And then they had this other kind of love, which is even more important in a way, called philia, spelled P-H-I-L-I-A. And that was about the deep friendship that could develop between brothers who fought next to each other on the battlefield, and this kind of thing. Someone you'd almost die for. And we all know about those relationships, how important they are to us. They had another kind of love, which was ludus, which is playful love, almost flirtatious. Then they had another one called pragma, which was the mature love that develops between a couple that have been together for years. And then a fifth kind of love was agape, which was their word for selfless love, you know, a love of strangers. And finally, they had this kind of love called philautia, which was self-love. And that's not a narcissistic kind of love, but actually a healthy love of the self that allows you then to love other people, and rather than be bitter and twisted, but someone who you give to yourself, then you can also give to others. And I think, well, let's cultivate that whole variety of love.
That should work for all of language, because language is words, like the word love. I've discussed it on here a few times. It's just bounded around all the time as just a sort of, it's a meaningless word now in my mind. I love you. I love this. I love that. I love, it's so, love, it can just cover all things, can't it? And the way you describe it, it's like the word, how do I say this without getting myself in trouble? That's the problem with all these things. Like the word bullying, everybody now is bullied if you don't agree with someone. Oh no, what's the other word that people use all the time? Offended. That's the big one, isn't it? I'm offended. It means I don't agree with you. Oh no, I'm offended. I don't like you not agreeing with me. We need different words maybe. Maybe the language needs to be spread so there's more words.
Yeah, I like that idea of trying to find that variety. I like looking for it in history, or even just playing with the words or expressions we use every day. So for example, a lot of people talk about their leisure time as time off. Well, why not talk about that as time on?
Yes.
You know, if we talk about it as time off, that kind of devalues it. That means Brilliant. Our work time is, you know, what our employer owns. Mm. But actually, I really want to own my time. I want my leisure time to be my real time on. That's what I'm going to switch myself on.
Yeah, or in a minute, just remind everyone that you're going to teach us how to live our lives. But how do you learn your stuff? I mean, how do you go about learning the things that you discuss and talk about?
Well, it's not obvious how to become a philosopher or a social philosopher. You can't really do a degree in the art of living. I think it's partly about experience and conversations. One of my mottos is to have a conversation with a stranger at least once a week. And you know, talk to the kind of people I don't normally talk to, whether it's a homeless guy on the street, or last night I had dinner with a very wealthy investment banker who was really interesting talking about his obsession with playing the saxophone. You know, these things that surprise us about people, I think, open up your own mind for how to live. And I'm just one of those people, I don't know about you, but I'm constantly asking myself, am I living in the right way? Can I be a better parent? How can I make my work more meaningful or fulfilling? These are just the things that always in my mind.
I overthink everything. I cannot stop doing it. And I was having a discussion just today about theme parks and the economics of fun. It's just I just don't get it. But you know, the idea that you're going to queue up for all that time for a minute's worth of just don't understand it all. So I overthink it all, so it's good. But how do you make money doing your job?
Partly by selling books. So I've been a writer full time for about 10 years, and that puts shoes on my children's feet. And then I give talks as well to all sorts of people, whether it's talking to Google in California or going and talking about the different varieties of love to prisoners in Wandsworth Prison. I try and speak to lots of different kinds of groups.
Are you looking at trends as well? Are you a bit of a futurist? Are you sort of looking at the way we're living and then talking to Google and people about the way you think we should be living, or the way we are moving towards? Do you see those trends?
I sometimes look at trends. I'm interested in the future. Like, are we becoming a low empathy society, or what's happening to our freedom, the way it's being eaten up by consumer culture, where freedom's being reduced to a choice between brands, between Nike and Adidas, or iPhone and Samsung, and looking at how that's going in the future. But what really interests me is not so much futurology, but how as a society we can start thinking a bit more long-term about everything, whether it's artificial intelligence or climate change or the art of loving. You know, we're in a real short-term society. Politicians can't see past the next election. Businesses can't see past the next quarterly report. And we're all gorging on the immediate, right? Fast food, rapid fire texting, all this kind of stuff, the buy now button. You know, we are caught in the short now. We need to think about the long now.
I found that really frustrating in the last election. No one's talking about 10, 20 years time, which is what I want to buy into.
Yeah.
They're talking about now, and that's all that people are buying into. I found the whole thing so frustrating. Mark will verify that, as I bored him a lot with those subjects. How hard is it to live in Britain at the moment?
How hard is it to live in Britain at the moment?
You're from Australia, right?
I am Australian. I mean, I find it incredibly difficult. And I have to put my cards on the table. Since Brexit, I found it increasingly challenging, partly because my dad's Polish, and last time he was here, just after the referendum, I was worried about what was going to happen to him when he was talking Polish in a Polish deli around the corner from where I live in Oxford. So what I see is this kind of growing us versus them mentality, whether it's people from different cultural backgrounds or between rich and poor. And I find that pretty hard in terms of, you know, making Britain a place to live and watching my kids grow up. But I think I'd probably see that everywhere. I think this is happening in other countries too. I go back to Australia and I see a lot of the same stuff going on.
Is Britain better to live than most places? It must be, mustn't it? I mean, as countries go in the world, we must be up there.
Well, there was this philosopher called John Rawls, who in the early 1970s, he had this idea that if you want to work out what's a great country to live in or what a just society looks like, imagine a thought experiment where you could be born in any country at any social level, rich or poor. It's going to be random. So the question is, where do you want to be born? Now, I wouldn't want to be born in Ghana or Mozambique, because you probably, chances are, you might end up, you know, living in a mud hut somewhere. Where would I want to be born? Well, I think Britain would be pretty good. The Netherlands would be pretty good. Wouldn't mind being Sweden or Australia. So I think if it's sort of random like that, you know, yeah, Britain's not such a bad bet.
But the one thing I always think about living in Britain, being born in Britain, is I'm free. And I think we take it for granted too much. I have a passport. Apparently a very small percentage of the world still has a passport. I can get on a plane and travel anywhere on our planet. There's people, the majority of the people who live in the planet won't even go 10 miles out from where they're born. So we are free, and I think it's so important. And we've got to always look at our politicians. Every time they introduce more laws to control us, I worry, because I think, hold on, you're just eroding away at my freedom every single little bit. I mean, coming from Australia, I think the idea of compulsory voting is horrific. I think that's so takes away your freedom. You should be able to have the right to vote and the right not to vote. And I think the problem with compulsory voting, it means the system stays, because it's always 100% people are voting 100% of the time. So it's wrong for the people to always endorse something like that. Freedom's important for me. And do you see that in the world, that this is one of the great things about living in somewhere like Britain, Australia?
Yeah, I do, actually. And that's why the new book I've written, Carpe Diem Regained, is all about freedom. It's about how do we be agents in our life? How do we almost be the author of our own lives? And if you go back to this Roman poet, Horace, who invented the term Carpe Diem, seize the day, 2,000 years ago, he wrote this little poem. And the last couple of lines, there's only 8 lines long, really sum up what it's all about. He said, "Even as we speak, envious time flies past. Seize the day and leave as little as possible for tomorrow." And that's all about, okay, how do I exercise my freedom in the face of death? You know, the clock is ticking. What choices am I going to make? I don't want to feel constrained. And I think it's really interesting. There's lots of different meanings of carpe diem. You ask somebody, what does seizing the day mean to you? And for some people, it's about grasping a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. For you, it might be being free of control from government and regulations.
It is.
For other people, it's all about hedonistic blowouts.
I think we've got to wake up every day and go, hey, I can hop on a plane if I want. I've probably got a passport. And if I haven't, I can go and get one. And I think that there's that's an amazing thing we have in this country and a lot of Western society. Right, Carpe Diem Regained, The Vanishing Art of Seizing the Day, is your book. What are we right in saying that the idea of the book is that humans learn to seize the day, but it's been hijacked by those evil marketing types, and you prescribe as taking it back? Is that where I'm at with this book? Is that the correct?
That is the essence of it. That there is this idea of seizing the day. We know it. Anyone who's seen the film Dead Poets Society, there's Robin Williams playing the inspiring school teacher Mr. Keating, and he's looking at these boys in this 1950s New England, you know, school, posh school, and he says to them, "We are food for worms, lads, because each and every one of us in this room is going to stop breathing, grow cold, and die. Carpe diem, seize the day, boys. Make your lives extraordinary." And I think we all get inspired by that, right? We kind of think, right, I want to live and grasp life by the neck and live as much as I can and squeeze every drop from it. But if you look at our society around us, I mean, how much seizing of the day are we really doing? I mean, I think Just Do It has really become Just Buy It. We're so busy seizing the credit card, we don't really have time to seize the day. And I doubt that the poet Horace really thought that the best way to exercise our freedom and seize the day was getting a bargain down at the forum. Seizing the day now is all about Black Friday shopping sprees and the instant hit of one-click online buying. You know, I think we can do a little bit better than that, don't you?
Yeah, well, 100%, yeah. I'm interested in the word YOLO, which came along about 10 years ago or something. I don't know however long it came along. And people just use that word as an excuse to do anything they want, but generally buy things or get drunk.
Yeah, absolutely. So you only live once is this, I think, quite a consumerist and quite limited view of what it means to seize the day. Of course, for some people, it's very meaningful. You know, the idea, okay, I'm going to, you know, you only live once, so I'm going to spend more time playing with my kids. You could go down that route. But when someone uses that hashtag YOLO, they're normally going out, binge drinking or whatever. But in fact,
when they tattoo it on themselves, it means they're going to Ibiza.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, those sort of YOLO tattoos, I quite like them because I think they represent a healthy kind of hedonism. And I think the seeking of pleasure is something that's being bashed out of us by contemporary cultures in some way. I mean, if you open a self-help book, right?
Yeah.
It's very unlikely that it'll say deal with your problems by downing a few tequila slammers or smoking a joint under the stars. But this is what human beings have been doing for centuries. When the Spanish conquistadors arrived in the Americas, they found the Aztecs tripping on magic mushrooms, right? And I think we need to allow for a little bit of that in our lives. I mean, my kids, not that they trip on magic mushrooms because they're only about 8 and a half, I mean, they understand this. So if they see, especially when they were little, actually, when they're about 3, if they saw a patch of grass, what would they do? They'd step onto it and start spinning round and round and round until they fell over, right? They wanted an altered state of consciousness, kind of like drug taking, but without the drugs. They understood the pleasures of hedonism. So, you know, it's not such a bad thing, that YOLO culture, if you can keep it under control.
You talk a lot about death in the book, which is interesting because, again, on this podcast, we've discussed it. And again, it's something which is it's been a big part of my life. My brother died and he was quite young, 37. And I suddenly had to face mortality. And so I started thinking a lot about death. And it's bizarre because you've got quite a lot of stuff about lying on your deathbed. And I contemplate that a lot, where you lie there and you look back. And so whenever I'm doing anything, I always think, in my deathbed, will I care about that? The problem with that is that nothing really is that important. So you could spend a lot of time going, no, I'm not doing it because on my deathbed, I won't care. So that is the problem with it. But explain why death is important, or your deathbed is important.
Well, I think we live in a culture where we're more afraid of talking about death than almost anything else. It's as taboo a topic as sex was in the Victorian era. And it's obvious why. The advertising industry tells us that we're forever young, or we shunt the elderly away into care homes out of sight and out of mind. But you can't really seize the day and exercise your freedom unless you have a little bit of a taste of death on your lips, unless you know that the Grim Reaper might take you at some point. Otherwise, you're going to spend the life on your sofa. So what I did in my book is I looked at how in human history, human cultures have discovered about 5 or 6 different ways of thinking about death in a healthy and sort of not morbid way.
Is this a deathbed test?
Well, that's one of the ways. So one of the ways is to try and live a life without regret. I think basically we ought to do a daily death pause. By that, I mean, spend about 5 minutes a day thinking about your death. And one of the deathbed tests I think of is like project yourself to the end of your life.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in fact, actually do this. Imagine yourself at a dinner party in the afterlife. Okay. This is like a thought experiment. You're at a dinner party in the afterlife, and there at the dinner party are all the other yous who you could have been.
Oh, no.
If you'd made different choices. So there's the you who actually managed to keep your marriage together and hold it together. There's the you who studied really hard and became a vet rather than giving up and doing something else. There's the you who almost died in a car accident. There's a you who was a selfish bugger and, you know, never really cared about your friends or family or whatever. And the question is, which of these yous do you want to talk to, or which of them would you rather be or become? Which of them might you find annoying? And I think this is quite a really interesting way of trying to think about, okay, what do I really want to do with my life? Who do I want to be when I look back on it?
So that's one of the ways of looking at death. What's the other way then?
So another way is to follow the ancient Stoic or ancient Roman idea of live every day as if it were your last. So the Roman philosopher Seneca was into this. Steve Jobs was into this.
Yeah, I'm interested in the Steve Jobs bit. I've actually highlighted that in the book because obviously everyone knows Steve Jobs. He's the old owner of Apple. He's dead now. passed pancreatic cancer, wasn't he? Passed.
That's right.
A couple of years ago, and he said this. I'll just read the end of it. If what he says, he says, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no, far too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. So that's how he lived his life. That he gave a talk, didn't he? And that was one of the things.
That's right. He said he used to look in the mirror every morning and ask himself that question, if this were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And I think that inspires a lot of people, that idea, okay, let's live every day as if it were my last. But I really wonder about that. I think partly it's a little bit too short term for me. I mean, why, you know, that might entice you to blow all your money on a wild spending spree or blow your relationship on an affair, you know. And why should we just look at, you know, live every day as if it were your last? Why not live as if not you had one day left, but as if you had 6 months left or 10 years left? Maybe that might encourage you to do long-term but still meaningful projects that you might not otherwise do. Or I sometimes wonder, well, why not live every day as if it were your first rather than as if it were your last? Like kids who look in wonder when they see a giraffe for the first time or snow for the first time. Imagine if we had that sense of wonder where you're living every day and seeing everything as if for the first time. So, but you know, I still quite like that idea of living every day as if you're last. I mean, my dad is 83 now, and when he comes and visits me from Australia every year, you know, I sometimes think, right, he's not going to be around much longer. So whenever I'm with him, I think, okay, this is the last day I'm going to be with him. I don't actually go and say that to him out loud, but it makes me, you know, laugh more with him, go down to the pub more with him, you know, cry more with him, all sorts of things. And it helps with that everyday connection.
Why do we end up not doing that then as humans?
I think partly because we fear death. We are so afraid of it that we can barely talk about, and we displace our fear of it. So I think there's lots of research showing that the reason people put so much energy into their careers and earning money or social status is that it's just a way of not thinking about death. So there's this very famous experiment by a psychologist called Sheldon Solomon, and people were told to look at a computer screen, and the word death was flashed up in front of them so quickly they couldn't even see it. And then what the psychologist found out, that after being having had that word death flashed up in front of them, they were more likely to want to buy a fast car or a fancy watch or go on, you know, luxurious holidays. In other words, all those things that we do are ways of distracting us from death. We've sort of lost having a healthy relationship with it.
So what's the frustration with marketing people taking hold of it then and using it? Aren't they helping us out?
Well, do you think that they are making us think more about death or less
not.
About
no,
death?
No, of course not, but I want you to explain it. Oh, I see what you mean. Sorry, you asked me a question. Yeah, they're making me think less about death, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, they want us to be young, to, you know, invest our money in this, in that, to buy clothes, to, you know, not think, well, what is the point of doing all this consumerism and so on, you know. But in some ways, of course, it is in their interest to get us to think about death, so we buy life insurance policies and that kind of stuff. But in general, we live in a youth-obsessed culture.
Though we had Will Storr on not so long ago, who was discussing his book Selfie and how we've become self-obsessed and selfish, and the whole marketing campaign, I suppose, is aimed at that. Do we have to be careful not to be too selfish, though? If we're living every day like it's our last one, do we have to? I think you talk about it with Steve Jobs a bit in your book, don't you? Because we could start going, it's all just about me and I don't care about
That's
anybody
right. I mean,
else. And,
just
and
because
you
it's your
that.
Last day doesn't mean it's everybody else's too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm living every day as my last, I need to have a bit of a sense of moral responsibility. So, for example, in my book, I tell the story of the great American writer Maya Angelou, who died a couple of years ago at the age of 86. Now, she was a carpe diem addict.
Right.
And she had all these different jobs. Most people know her as a poet and writer, but in fact, she was San Francisco's first tram attendant in the 1950s. She ran a brothel. She was a prostitute. She worked for Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, all these things. But sometimes she made seize-the-day decisions which were quite damaging. So at one point, she had to decide whether she was going to leave America and go for a year as a dancer in Europe. And she decided, she had 4 days to make this decision, and she made this decision, right, seize the day, carpe diem, she's going for a year, suddenly decides. But the cost was she left behind her 9-year-old son for a year. And he was really traumatized by this experience. And I think it's a reminder that when we seize the day, we've got to think of, you know, who else is this going to affect? I'm not just seizing it for me, but maybe I should be living in a way that I'm seizing the day for everybody, or at least thinking about everybody around me.
Yeah, on a bigger scale, we've got climate change happening on a huge scale. And if we're going, hey, but it's good for me not to care about it, then we're not caring about everybody else. It surely is a world we've got to come together and say we need to think about, you know, different ways we perceive the world and not be too hedonistic in that respect.
Yeah, and I want to create a world where my kids are able to seize the day too.
Yeah.
You know, in 50 years' time or 30 years' time or 60 years' time. So I can't just pursue my own self-interest all the time.
Does it frustrate you when you're a social philosopher, you're analysing our lives and seeing the way we're living? Does it frustrate you that you can see stuff and you can see us not living our lives like that and you can see the way we're being manipulated? Does it frustrate you?
Well, you know, I see all these problems in myself as well. You know, so for example, I look at society around me, I think, okay, we're spending too much time looking at our screens. That's obvious. 8 hours a day on average, we become spectators of life on the screen rather than living it directly ourselves. You know, the average person checks their phone 110 times a day.
You want to grayscale it. That's what I've done, and then it stops doing it.
Well, what I've just done is actually I just downgraded from a smartphone to an unsmartphone.
I was going to do that, but I like podcasts too much, and I have to listen to them. Anyway, go on. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, so, you know, now if I want to send a text, I've got to press about 16 buttons, and it's an absolute nightmare. But so I look in frustration at the world around how it's changing, but I also see that I'm part of that culture too. And I'm always struggling with these things. I've written a book about seizing the day because I look at myself and think,
yes,
God, I just spend too much time reading books, for example, rather than living, you know, living life. You know, I read about people having adventurous lives rather than doing it myself. And that's completely mad.
Yes. That there's something I've thought about often. What, reading books and watching films, shouldn't I be doing this myself and living my own life? We mentioned Steve Jobs earlier there. Because if you listen to that quote from Steve Jobs, you go, oh, that's brilliant. That's how I'm going to live my life. But you do make a point in the book that maybe it isn't all great what he's saying, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. That, I mean, he was, you know, a rich guy living in California, could do whatever he wanted. But there are all sorts of different ways of thinking about death and mortality, apart from just living every day as if it were your last. One of the ones I really like is, this is a bit of a brain twister, is live every day as if it were for the second time.
Right.
Okay, so let me just explain that. There's this great film. I don't know if you see it. It's called About Time. It's a Richard Curtis film, you know, the guy who did Notting Hill. And this is a good way to explain the idea, really. It's about a guy and his father who find out that the men in their family have this ability to put their mind, or just to change the past. They can go back to a moment in any time in the past and change its direction. And the beginning of the film, this young man, he turns 21, he now has this ability to go back into the past, and so he goes and changes the past, so he gets himself a nice girlfriend and so on. That bit's a bit boring. Get to the end of the film, the father says to the son, hey son, I'm going to tell you the secret of happiness. What I do is this: I live every day normally, and then I use my secret power to go back and live every day for a second time. But this time I really do it properly. I look the cashier in the eye. I listen to the sound of the blackbird as I walk to work. I really focus on it and I'm really there in the moment. And then the young man realizes that actually he doesn't even need his superpower anymore. He can just live every day as if it were for the second time, as if he were coming back to it.
Mm.
Okay. So just imagine if we lived our lives like that. And when you wake up in the morning, you really, you know, look your partner in the eye and, you know, greet them rather than just jumping out of bed. You know, all these little ways in which we're not appreciating the moments of our life. And I think if you live every day as if for the second time, that's a pretty good approach to the art of living, not just the Steve Jobs way.
I think we are, you've mentioned it with the smartphones, I think we're creating ways not to live our lives. I think that could be a problem. It's a distraction from actually living our lives.
Yeah, we totally live in an age of distraction, and we're distracted by, you know, partly by digital culture, partly by, I think we're in an age of hyper-scheduled living. You know, rather than just do it, we really just plan it as well. We're constantly filling up our electronic calendars weeks or months in advance. There's no time left for being spontaneous. And spontaneity has always been a really important part of seizing the day.
Okay, we're going to go through those bits in the book in just a minute. But just before we get there, you mentioned Steve Jobs a minute ago. And I always think of Richard Branson as one of these as well. They're always going, yeah, do it, seize the day. They have got quite a lot of money behind them to get in hot air balloons or to, you know, buy islands or do whatever. Most of us have responsibilities. We've got to make sure there's food on the table, pay our mortgages, you know, we've got all our bills and stuff. Seizing the day is not the greatest. It's a lot harder, isn't it, just for the normal folk.
Absolutely. You know, Richard Branson can go and kite surf around the world, and you know, screw it, just do it, as he says it. But I think for the rest of us, we've got to think about, what are the areas of my life where I can seize the day? You may not be able to do it in your work because you're trying to pay the mortgage off and so on, and you can't suddenly go off and open an otter sanctuary in Devon or whatever it happens to be. But you might be able to seize the day in your relationships or in your love life, to actually pick up the phone and phone your brother or sister who you haven't spoken to for a few years. That's not about being rich and poor, black or white. It's just something that we can all do about making better choices in our lives and being a bit more conscious of our actions.
Okay, we discuss a few of the things in your book. Because as I've promised all through this, you're going to teach us how to live our lives properly.
Haven't I already done it?
Well, sort of, yeah. So the art of seizing opportunities, what does that, that's one of your chapters. What does that mean to us then, the listener listening to this? How do they do that?
Okay, so the idea of seizing an opportunity in life is the most common way people think of carpe diem or seizing the day. Okay, and it's all about grasping those once in a lifetime moments, whether it's a chance to change career or to, you know, rescue a crumbling relationship. And it's a really interesting thing about where the word opportunity comes from. It actually comes from another Latin phrase, which is ob portum veniens, which means coming towards a port, and it originally referred to a wind that will blow a ship into harbor. So you can think of an opportunity as a wind blowing to your advantage. The question is, are you going to raise your sails and catch that wind, or are you so afraid of being smashed on the rocks that you don't do it at all? Now, the problem is that, of course, we're all afraid. We're worried about risks. We seek security rather than change. This is just what humans are like. So how then do you take opportunities that come your way if you're worried about them or if you're procrastinating? And I think the key to this is, well, in a way, if I built a temple to carpe diem, to seizing the day, over the front I would carve in the words, act now, think later. And I think this is the key to it. You know, our culture tells us to do the opposite. So to think first and act afterwards. So if you're thinking, right, changing jobs, say, a career counselor will tell you to do lots of research and do some personality tests and write down long lists of your strengths and weaknesses, narrow down the options, and then start sending out your CV. Now, that might get you a job. That's a think first, act later attitude, but it's unlikely to be a fulfilling one because you haven't tried stuff out in reality. Job shadowing or volunteering, this kind of thing. And actually, if you want to get fulfilling work, flip it around. Act first, think afterwards. Go out there, get a bit of experience, learn about who you are, make mistakes. I met this woman who, for her 30th birthday, took a year off and tried out 30 different jobs. She worked part-time to earn enough to live on. And at the end, she realized, you know, she was totally wrong about what she thought about some careers. So act first, think afterwards. That's how you get over it. Well, weirdly, actually, that she got so much media attention from her project to try out 30 different jobs, she in fact got asked to write a book about it. That's what she ended up doing.
There you go. So that's an opportunity for you. You saying that, though, it just made me scared. It sort of made me feel really weird. You saying the idea of just go for something. I mean, I just went for a career in TV when I was younger, but I had no responsibilities and I didn't really have a career and I didn't have an education or anything, so I had nothing to lose. But somebody in a job, if you're saying just go for it, that's quite a risk, isn't it? It makes feel...
It's tough. I mean, if I think of my dad, who was a refugee from Poland to Australia after the Second World War, all he wanted was security. He'd had a really turbulent childhood. And so he just wanted to have a house in the suburbs, you know, and be right in the middle of the middle classes. That was his dream. And that's what he achieved. And that's what I grew up in. And I was lucky I had that. But we've all had different life experiences. But I think in the end, life is about taking risks and falling and getting back up again. And things are never quite as scary as you think they're going to be. Look, you started doing a podcast. Maybe you were petrified. I don't know. But you start doing it and it starts becoming a habit. It starts becoming normal. And sometimes things fail. I mean, the word, you know, this is about experimental living, right? And the word experiential living, and the word experience has the word experiment in it. And inside that is another little Latin word, which is periculum, which means danger.
Right.
And What is life without a little bit of danger?
If you could see my body language now, I've got myself all tight here because there's something amazing about security, and I'm a pack animal. I'm still part of nature, and I just think if I don't go outside of my security blanket, then I can just stay safe and warm. And you're making me visualize going away from what I want.
Okay, let's think about that for a moment. Okay, where does that come from? That feeling that you want to be secure. Okay, this comes from human evolution, and human evolution has led us to being risk averse, to wanting to avoid risk. There's a very famous psychology experiment where people were asked to bet on a toss of a coin. Okay, and if the coin landed down tails, you would lose $100. The question is, how much would you have to win when it landed heads for you to be willing to take the bet? So if the coin was going to land tails, you'd lose $100. And if it landed heads, you'd win $100. Most people won't take that bet. Now, if the coin lands tails, you lose $100 and you win $150, still people won't take the bet. But if it lands tails, you lose $100 and it lands heads and you win $200, most people will take that bet.
Of course.
And the psychologists decided at the end, their conclusion was, we hate losing about twice as much as we like winning. Or, you know, the pain from a loss is about double the pleasure from a gain.
Oh.
And now that is what's wired into your and my brain. And it makes sense in the sense that we grew up on the African savannah. Human beings developed for 2 million years at a time where if you saw a succulent red berry, it was pretty good to be wary of it because it might kill you. Now, we don't live in that world today. We don't need to avoid risk that much. And the problem with this way our brains are wired for risk aversion is that if you're suddenly given the opportunity to move to Berlin, you are going to focus on everything that could possibly go wrong rather than what might go right. So I actually find that quite liberating, knowing that my old brain is trying to take me in the direction of security rather than freedom. And that actually makes me feel a little bit more free.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think? Convince you, or are you still worried about change?
Do you know what I liked? I really do like change. I like evolution. I like evolution as in future, that sort of evolution of my life, not evolution. But I love all that. I love all that sort of stuff. But you just talking about it is making me feel quite weird. I don't know why. It's just the idea that I would relocate to Berlin or something is like, oh, God, no.
Well, look, I'm not saying do this every day. I don't relocate to Berlin every day. But for example, I've been pretty experimental in my careers. I've done. I used to be an academic. I gave that up. I thought it was boring. I was a journalist. I gave that up. I was a professional gardener. That didn't work out. I gave that up. You know, I tried lots of different things. And the problem is that we're really bad judges of our future selves. You might decide when you're 16 what you want to do with your life, say become a lawyer, whatever it is. And, well, what do you know about being a lawyer? I mean, nothing really when you're 16. And we get locked into these things. And once you realize that we're pretty bad judges of who we are and who we're going to be, then I think it becomes a little bit easier to be a bit more experimental. Yeah. I mean, it's hard, though, of course, because as you say, we want security, but nobody lives in a secure world anymore. I mean, I mentioned my dad. He worked for the same company for 51 years. Now the average job lasts only 4 years. So we're constantly having to make choices today. Everyone is having to make choices. Nobody is secure anymore.
Yeah, I met someone the other day, a journalist, and I said to him, how are you getting on? He goes, I've just retired. And I said, oh, is that a good idea? He goes, it depends how long I live for. And I thought, that's fantastic, because he's like, if I'm going to live a long time, no, it's not, because I haven't got enough money. But, you know, if I've only got 20 years left, yeah, it's a great idea. I just thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. It's also choice. We've got masses of choice, haven't we, now? And I think there's another one. You know, you talk about looking at our future selves. That gives people anxiety, gives me anxiety. A choice is also something which gives a lot of anxiety. There's so much choice now, isn't there?
Yeah, but what kind of choices are we offered? Yeah, you can go to the supermarket and get 17 kinds of washing powder or 25 kinds of biscuit. I mean, they're not really the meaningful choices in life, but we do, in fact, have more choices than in the past. I mean, thinking back to careers again, back in the 18th century, you know, there's only about 3 or 4 different jobs you might think of doing. You probably do what your father did, you know, and become a baker if they were a baker or something. Now you go on a jobs website and there's 12,000 different careers you could follow. And there's something psychologists call the paradox of choice. This is the idea that the more choice you get, the harder it is to make a choice. You're like a rabbit caught in the headlights. You're so worried about making the wrong choice that you don't make any choice at all. And this is one of the problems, a lot of the reasons why people stay stuck in jobs or relationships which aren't actually working.
But people like joining clubs or religions, or because they show you the way. You'd have to make the choice, don't you? That's again human nature, our security, isn't it?
Yeah, I think partly we do want the choices made for us, but also we join in those communities because community matters. It isn't, you know, though I've written a book about freedom and seizing the day, carpe diem, it isn't the only thing that matters in life, right? I mean, there's another big thing that matters in life, which is the quality of our relationships, having a sense of belonging. Now, religions, football clubs, community choirs, all these things are ways of getting a little bit of community. You know, 1 in 4 people today say that they are lonely, chronically lonely, with no deep friendships. Well, that's a kind of terrible state of society, isn't it? So we're constantly trying to bridge that gap, trying to find ways to connect with people. But we live in a digital world where we might have lots of friends on Facebook or whatever, but how many of them are face-to-face relationships, someone where you can really go and talk to them when things are difficult?
I suppose the digital world, though, has opened up a lot more opportunities for people who could seize the day, because you can invent yourself, not just in a personal way, but in a career way. You can reinvent yourself or invent yourself as somebody or something on the internet, and you can communicate with the whole of the world.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of opportunities there. You know, if you're really into whatever it happens to be, archery or video gaming or whatever, you know, you can make careers, all these kinds of things online. But at the same time, I think that, I don't mean to be so negative about online culture, but I think it does tend to separate us from people. I mean, the more Facebook interactions you have, the more narcissistic that you're likely to be.
Right.
And I think we're still learning to use the internet to create real communities. I think we're still not good at that yet.
You touched on hedonism earlier. Let's go back to that, because it's an exciting word, isn't it? Should we be dating everybody? Is that what you mean by hedonism? When you talk about hedonism, should we have multiple partners? It'll drop off, Roman. But what should we be doing? What's hedonism? Does that mean partying or multiple partners, or what should we be doing?
Obviously, you're interested in multiple partners. Otherwise, you've been mentioned so many times.
Only because we've discussed affairs a lot recently on this podcast, and it seems to make people very unhappy, that sort of lifestyle. The hedonistic lifestyle doesn't seem to be the sort of lifestyle that that'll give you the happiness you require in life.
Yeah, I don't think happiness. I don't think hedonism has to be all about having extramarital affairs and that kind of thing. You know, going on to those websites like Ashley Madison, which is the famous one where, you know, you go on and to try and have an extramarital affair with somebody else who wanted an extramarital affair. That was a kind of seize the day website, but that's not what I'm talking about. I think it's about, in the 17th century, this is going to sound a bit obscure, if you ask someone, what does carpe diem mean to you? They would have said, it's about hedonistic exploration. And what they meant by that, it was partly about gastronomy, it was partly about sex, but it was about exploring the senses. It didn't necessarily mean go off with somebody else, but it's about having direct experience of life rather than, as you know, today, be doing that rather than spending all our time on our phones. And that doesn't require necessarily smashing your relationships apart. I mean, even in tiny little ways, we can explore our senses. So something I started really doing, even eating, when I eat a tangerine, right? I read this really great trick about how to eat a tangerine properly. You peel it and you take off the little tiny individual pieces and you put them on top of the radiator in the morning. And then you take them off in the afternoon and they become all plump and the outsides are almost like porcelain and you eat them. And it is sensual. It is exquisite.
Oh, no, they'd be warm, Roman.
No, oh, it's lovely. No. Oh, it's lovely. And these tiny little ways we can, you know, bring a bit of sensuality back into our lives. Now, you could do it by taking drugs and all that kind of stuff. But one of the problems here is I'm quite into democratic hedonism, you know, spreading it around a bit, not letting hedonism just be for, you know, the rich and powerful or the famous or whatever, trying to let everyone, you know, get a little bit of a touch of it.
I'm worried about, we're touching on the digital age. I'm worried about the children at the moment, and I've got teenage daughters. They spend so much of their lives on their smartphones and things. And I think they're missing out on, what's a good way of saying it? It's the senses, basically, nature. I do think it's going to come around, though. I think all these things do. What do you think from your position as a social philosopher? Well, one day one of them is going to go, one of their peer group, and is going to say, hey, let's just go and see nature. Or do you think it's gone forever? It must come round, back round again.
You would hope that it would. And my hope is that it would. And if I meet smart and savvy teenagers, they say, yeah, I'm on my phone a lot, but I'm just arranging things. And then I still value face-to-face conversations or climbing a tree and smoking a joint under the stars or whatever it happens to be, you know, real life experiences. And I think the fact that something like that Steve Jobs video called How to Live Before You Die just went completely viral, has had over 40 or 50 million views, that just shows that people are hungry for more experiential living. We all know that we should be living more directly in the world rather than through our screens. The problem is that most digital culture is stronger than us. I mean, it's as if we've all got a little kind of slot machine in our pockets. A billion people have, you know, a slot machine in their pockets because, you know, like you might go, you know, you go to Las Vegas and you pull the arm of the one-armed bandit and you get your three strawberries or cherries coming up in a row. Or if you almost get them, you think, oh, I might get them next time. Well, this is just the same when we check our phones. It's like, oh, have I got another notification? Have I got, you know, another like or something like that? We're constantly wanting to check and we become addicted to it. And these things are designed to make us addicted. So they're very hard to, you know, challenge.
Yeah, I've got a theory. Will you indulge me and listen to it?
I want you to feel indulged. Tell me.
In the 70s and 80s, there was this new type of food, which was really at the time, it was frozen food that was happening. Microwave meals, ready meals, McDonald's, fast food. It all happened. And I remember the conversations. We were like, we're all going to be eating a pill soon. And food was going that way. You know, you take something out. It was a potato waffle or a pancake, you know, one of those pancakes, sort of savory pancake, everything. And it was all cooked for 10 minutes and eat it, or cooked for 20 minutes and eat it. Then along came a lot of people who went, actually, I wouldn't mind eating real food again. And I think that is the potential with the digital age, is we're all going to go so far down a road and then people are going to go, well, hold on, I want to get off this. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, if I look at myself, having just downgraded from a smartphone to an unsmartphone, I'm trying to go on that route myself.
So that's why I've just grayscaled my phone to try and do it.
Fantastic. But I mean, the other thing that my wife and I have just done, we now have put a box in the hallway of our house, and when somebody comes in, we invite them to leave their phone in there. when they come over for lunch or dinner. Now, people get very jumpy about this because we don't want...
No one's coming over anymore, Roman.
Well, we don't want people staring at their phones with our kids, our 8.5-year-old kids looking at this all the time. Yeah. If my wife and I use our phone in front of our children, they can fine us 10p, right?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
And so I think we've got to be on the battlefield in a way and, you know, have these sort of digital diets. But I think that's not enough because you can't just reject digital culture. You have to also point yourself towards something more positive. That's why I like hedonism in its broader sense, exploring the senses, because actually it's a little bit more positive. We all know there's a big difference between watching Strictly Come Dancing and going out dancing yourself. So, you know, go out and do it. Yeah, it's nice to watch telly, and great things on telly there can be stimulating, but go out and taste a bit of life and have a bit of that adventure and just remind yourself how fantastic that can be.
Let's talk about mindfulness, sorry. Because you make a point on mindfulness. Mindfulness is huge at the moment. What's your theory on it?
I'm a bit naughty in this book because I kind of go for mindfulness. I'm a bit critical of it. Now, I've done lots of mindfulness courses myself. You know, there tend to be two kinds. There's the Buddhist version of mindfulness. It's all about these breathing techniques, bring you into the now. And then there's these secular forms of mindfulness, which a lot of people have done in schools or community centers, things like mindfulness-based stress reduction or mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. It's basically Buddhist meditation without the Buddhism, as you probably know. And there's loads of evidence showing this stuff is great for helping people deal with stress and depression, anxiety, help you stop smoking, deal with heart disease. The problem, though, one of the problems I found doing my research for my book is actually there's lots of different ways of getting into the present moment, and mindfulness is only one of them, and we shouldn't let it dominate or monopolize. I mean, just think, for example, of what psychologists call flow experience. That's where you're so engaged in an activity, like playing a high-speed basketball game, that all sense of time disappears, the past and the future. You're right there in the zone, as athletes say. And you know, as psychologists say, you know, this is very different from mindfulness. You're often doing something quite difficult, something creative, but it really puts you in the present moment. So that's another way of getting into the now, apart from mindfulness meditation. Then there's what's, you know, you might call, or psychologists call, exuberance. Around 1 in 10 people have a naturally exuberant personality. Think of Maria in The Sound of Music, singing her heart out in the Austrian Alps. She just can't help being alive and being passionate about her life. And then there's a third, another form of being in the present moment, which is what I call or might think of as collective ecstasy. You know, you're dancing, you're at a rave, you're all together. There's the pulse of the music and you're collectively there in the now. You're not consciously trying to be there in the present moment, but there you are in the moment. So I think we need to cultivate all these different ways of being in the present moment.
In defense of mindfulness, not that it needs defending at all, I think people have taken mindfulness and they've changed the meaning of it slightly. I think it's become about being calm and being in control. I talked to Hemant Suman, the Buddhist monk. He came on Sunday brunch and I had a really lovely chat with him. And I said to him, I talked to him a lot throughout the morning. I said, do you get jealous and do you get angry? And he said, yeah, and I really enjoy it. So it's the thing is, it's I think when they come, when they know what they're doing in mindfulness, isn't it about just observing yourself? And actually it's about living life more if you do it properly, because you can see the thrill and the ecstasy and the anger and the jealousy and everything. You can see it and go, wow, this is living.
Yeah, I think it is partly having a kind of hyper state of awareness of the world. But what I found really interesting is when I talked to some Buddhist monks, that they were very critical of a lot of the mindfulness courses people do, the non-Buddhist ones, the secular ones, because what the Buddhists say is, I spoke to this very famous Buddhist monk called Matthieu Ricard, who's known as the happiest man in the world. His brain's been measured. He hates that term, by the way. And he said to me, I said, what do you think of these modern mindfulness courses that everybody's doing in companies and schools and so on? He said, well, the problem is you could have a mindful sniper or a mindful psychopath. I mean, to be a great sniper, you need to be totally there in the now, absolutely focused, non-judgmental, kill people and no judgment. He was only half joking because he knows mindfulness courses have become really popular amongst US Marines and military training, really popular amongst Wall Street bankers trying to stay calm during high stakes deal making and when the markets are turbulent. And from his point of view, the problem with a lot of these modern mindfulness courses, they're very me, me, me. They're all about my relaxation, my state of calm, and what about everybody else's? You know, whereas the Buddhists are sort of into concepts of compassion and kindness alongside mindfulness, knitting them together.
Will Storr will agree with you on that. It's one of the things he makes in his selfie book about mindfulness actually is whilst just trying to become self-obsessed, but in the inside as well. I'm sort of quoting him really badly there. Sorry, Will. but he sort of discussed very similar to what you're saying there. It's interesting because it's such a big phenomenon now.
Yeah, in fact, I've just come back from a book tour in the Netherlands and I was at a festival called Happiness with a Z on the end. And there's a lot of people there who are really into mindfulness and they were quite shocked when I started being critical of it. But they could also get it as well. They kind of knew that there's a bit of a me, me, me-ness to it all. And, you know, let's kind of widen it out a little bit, you know, and get it away from being about reinforcing the narcissistic culture that we're getting enough of from Facebook.
I was in a yoga center the other day and I just looked around and by the way, I think yoga's brilliant. I think mindfulness is brilliant before anybody starts writing in. But no, everyone was very serious, I noticed. And everyone was very, no one was smiling, very, very serious, very calm, but very serious. And I really wanted to stand on a table and go, hey, everyone.
That's partly why I'm into hedonism, right? Because we have become, you know, the modern happiness industry is very into self-control, very into moderation, very into me, me, me. And I think sometimes we just need to let go a little bit and be a little bit more experimental, to stand on the table and dance and shout and scream and cry and laugh or whatever it happens to be, and let our hair down if we've got it. And I'm losing it.
Yes, so am I. Spontaneity. What should we do with that?
There's a big problem with spontaneity, which is, this is a great tragedy in the history of the art of living. Human spontaneity, you may not know this, has been in decline for the last 400 years, and we have inherited this. We are less spontaneous than any human generation since about the 15th century. You might be thinking, what the hell are you talking about? Well, you know, if you think back to medieval carnival culture, people were really spontaneous then. They would be dancing and drinking and having sex on the streets, and there'd be public theater and public games and medieval carnival. And then that disappeared for three reasons. Partly due to the rise of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th and 17th century, where the very serious Northern European Calvinist churches started banning fairs and carnivals and public games. games. Then came along the Industrial Revolution and its greatest weapon, the factory clock. People started being measured on the assembly line, time and motion studies. We started, in fact, clocks even started changing. So before about 1700, most clocks only had hour hands. But after 1700, they started having minute hands. And by 1800, they mostly had second hands. Now, do we need minute and second hands? I'm not really sure, but life became more regimented. And then came along the third factor, which is, you know, our culture of hyper-scheduled living and time management. We are trying to be more efficient, battle off and beat off all those emails, have all these time management techniques, which are really ways of fitting more and more into our calendars, making us more and more busy, more and more productive and efficient, and not really opening us up to spontaneity. So we've got to reclaim spontaneity.
Doing what?
This is tricky. Now, in fact, the other day I told one of my babysitters who's 16, I said, human spontaneity has been in decline for 400 years. He said, what rubbish? He said to me, he said, look, me and my friends, we're really spontaneous. We're always texting each other at the last moment about let's go to this party or let's meet at that pub. And I think to myself, well, is that really spontaneity or is that really evidence of an epidemic of non-commitment driven by FOMO, fear of missing out? He's so worried about all the stuff going down the on the waterfall of his social media feeds that, you know, other people might be doing more interesting things than him, that he leaves his decisions to the last moment. It's a bit like you go to a party and someone's always looking over your shoulder in case someone more interesting comes through the room, someone more interesting to talk to. And so I think we need to get back to spontaneity. Question is, how? Now, I'm a bit subversive. So in my book, I talk about lots of different ways. But one of the ways I like challenging this just planet culture is by actually planning my spontaneity, which sounds mad. But literally, if you look at my diary, on Sunday afternoons between 3 and 6, I write in spontaneity time. So when 3 o'clock comes along on Sunday afternoon, I haven't planned anything. And I might say to my kids, right, let's go and have a picnic up a tree or something like that. And it sounds contradictory, doesn't it? Like planning being spontaneous, that is insane. But in fact, digital culture is so powerful that we almost have to have these artificial ways of challenging it. And I hope that I'm not always going to have to write spontaneity time into my diary. It might become a little bit more spontaneous, as it were, a bit more of a habit. But for the moment, I'm still doing it.
And your wife's always going, oh no, it's spontaneity time. We might have to go and have sex in the street.
Just try it. As long as you're playful about it, it doesn't matter if you've planned it.
No, I think it's illegal, Roman. Please don't go and have sex in the street. I'm not sure you're allowed to. Maybe a quiet street or something. Okay, so you're basically saying, look at your routine. We all get stuck in a routine, don't we? And you're sort of saying, look at your routine and think outside that routine. That's to make your life a little bit better.
And have less routine.
Get out of your routines.
Put parts of your week or your day where there absolutely is nothing planned.
And doing it together is the sort of another chapter in your book. What does that mean? We need to come together to seize the day as
well. There
a collective.
I'm actually thinking a little bit more politically,
right,
because we normally think of carpe diem as something about individuals, like in Dead Poet Society. It's about how I can make my own life or my everyday life more extraordinary. But I'm also interested in politics, because I think that as individuals we thrive as human beings, partly by following our own desires, but partly by also doing stuff with other people, you know, in the public sphere, in the political world, as it were. And throughout history, people have banded together to bring about change. Think of the people who helped bring down the Berlin Wall. They were really seizing the day. They were seizing an opportunity on a mass scale. They were being spontaneous, and they were partying. There was full of hedonism there too, as well as very, very serious political intentions. And I think if you're interested in political change now, in whatever form it is, whether it's to stop the right of far-right extremism in Europe or campaign against climate change, whatever you're into, women's rights, whatever, I think you're going to have a much better time if you tap into carpe diem, because most social movements die out, right? Because people get bored, they can't keep the energy up. So you need a little bit of partying, a little bit of music.
So aren't these authorities and the powers to be, another one of my bugbears this a bit, they're trying to stop it happening. What is it? What was that expression we had over here when people went protesting? We kettled them or something. What was that?
Yeah, thing? Oh, kettling. I've been kettled. So that's when the police kind of put you in a little cordon and you can't even move. Now, my parents-in-law...
I want to protest on the streets and yet you're not going to let me. It's like, I find that really astonishing because without protesting, we're not going to get the change we need.
Yeah, and people don't realise how much of this goes on. So my parents-in-law, who are pretty well-off people, live not very far from here, they went on one of their first protests ever, first street protest, which was against the building of another Heathrow runway. And they got kettled by the police. The police literally wouldn't let them leave the protest to go to the toilet. And they were shocked by this, right? They couldn't believe the police tactics. But this was quite normal. And all they were trying to do was have their say because they didn't think their local MPs or whatever were actually sticking up for them and their neighbours and what they really cared about. They were just trying to have a voice. And there they were being cordoned off by the police. And I think, well... this is a pretty authoritarian thing, isn't it?
This is not about me, it's about you, but it's one of my real bugbears, this, because I've gone back to it. Freedom is really important in this country. And when we start seeing things happen like that, and I know why they justify it by saying, well, these protests get violent, but I think it's a trade-off between stopping the violence happening, which clearly we don't want, but also saying you are free in this country to protest about anything you want. Because otherwise we're not going to have change. We're going to end up with the same old politicians, same old rules, same old laws. It needs, you know, we need reform regularly because we're growing as society, aren't we?
Yeah, and also I think we just can't rely on the politicians to do everything for us. You know, sometimes we got to do it ourselves. You got to make your voice heard. So I completely agree.
Exactly. Right. Okay. So to sum it up, I mean, it's about us relooking at our lives. And going, come on, just live a bit. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah, making that step from just thinking about wanting to be free and be the author of your own life to actually doing it. We all know there's stuff we want to do in our lives that we're holding back from. And in the end, we just need a kind of courage and to know it's okay if we fail at stuff, but that we are going to feel more fully alive when we make choices, when we make decisions, even if they're sometimes the wrong ones.
And notice maybe how... the world has hijacked seizing the day.
Yeah, I think you've got to be vigilant. You've got to think about what are the ways that my choices are being shaped for me. Am I doing all my seizing the day online shopping on Amazon? Or are there other actual ways to do it? And I think there are a few more other ways than do it than just clicking that buy now button.
Yeah, my mum always buys stuff and then says to my dad, but I saved money. Like, he just shakes his head. You can't save money if you're spending it. No, I did. It was supposed to be this much and I got 50% off. I saved money. We ask everyone, this is the book, by the way. That's the book. It's called Carpe Diem Regained. There's lots of stuff in there we haven't covered. Lots of case studies as well and lots of research. How long did that take you to write? It looks quite in depth.
It's all about two words, carpe diem. It took me 3 years.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of work gone into this.
It takes time. It's mad how much came out of just studying two words. But there we go. This is all about how to live. It's not always that easy. It's a bit complicated sometimes.
It is. Yeah. And it shouldn't be, should it? We're making it more complicated for ourselves.
Yeah. I think we can cut through all of that with a few thoughts on the art of living, which can really give us new direction.
We ask everyone who comes on 4 questions. The first one, what advice were you given that has been invaluable in your life?
Probably for me, the most important piece of advice was given to me by this old guy in his 70s. He did say to me, he said, have a conversation with a stranger once a week.
That's brilliant. Mark would hate that because Mark doesn't like strangers. Well, it's not that he doesn't like strangers. He struggles on public transport and stuff. If anyone looks at him or smiles at him. How do you go about doing that? I mean,
I think you need to be adventurous. You need to realize that people like to talk. So like, I'm a bit of an extremist. So I might say to somebody, well, what would you like written on your tombstone? Now, most people can't do that. But you might just, you know, ask somebody.
Well, you say that to a stranger.
Occasionally I have, but you know, I've been practicing for quite a few years like this. Sometimes I just ask them, you know, say, you know, what was the most surprising thing that you did last week or something like that? Just ask things which are not totally wild and weird.
I do just try and talk to everyone because I quite like yourself. I like listening to what other people say. And I talked to an American the other day and I said, how long have you been living here? And he said, oh, I've only been over here about 18 months now. And I said, what do you find strange about it? And he said, jaywalking. I'm still shocked every time someone walks across the road, because in he comes from New York. He said, in New York, nobody crosses the road unless the lights are on for you. So that's amazing. Again,
yeah, but I heard that the great anarchist Noam Chomsky never even walks across a red light or does jaywalking, and you know he's living in the United States, so I think that's right what you discovered.
That again, that's why we're free in Britain, because we can jaywalk without getting in trouble over here. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that can help them?
I think don't be afraid to think about death, to really just spend 3 minutes a day or 5 minutes a day contemplating your mortality. It's okay. And it can actually be fun. Think about whether you want to live every day for your last, or think about if you only had 6 months left to live, how do you want to live? These are just great ways of being in good existential health.
So you're not thinking about lying in a bed with a nurse next to you. You're thinking about the build up to it. What are you thinking?
It depends on the nurse.
Back to hedonism again. What mistake do people make? Maybe do your job, that not that many people do your job, but or just people in life generally. What do you want to go with that?
I think we have this idea that in life, particularly in careers, we ought to be high achievers, become an expert in a narrow field. I believe we ought to aim to be wide achievers rather than high achievers. Like, so to be a master of many things. Think of Leonardo da Vinci. In any 1 week, he would have been painting a portrait of an artistic patron, then devising some mechanical engineering device, and then doing some anatomy experiments on the weekend. I think we're all many people, and we have to learn to achieve wide rather than high.
Oh, we're not told to do that, are we?
No, not at all.
Society tells us to specialize in one thing and get on
with
that.
Absolutely. Of course we need specialists. Like if my dad has a heart operation, as he did, I want a proper heart surgeon doing it rather than someone who's doing it on the weekend just for kicks. But I think that
plumber during the week.
Exactly. But I think we can really allow the many petals of ourselves to come out, you know, and we ought to be doing a little bit more of that as a culture.
Yeah, and I suppose that is one of the things I've been talking about a lot as well with people and boring them with, is that you shouldn't let your jobs define you. And I think if you do that, you go wide, you won't let your job define you, because you'll have many things that you're known for rather than just that one thing.
Yeah, so I think if you're a natural wide achiever, you've just gone that way with your career, right? You're inventing, experimenting, and also you like talking to lots of different kinds of people.
Some people say I'm a one-trick pony, Roman.
You're a many-trick pony. I don't know if they're great tricks or not.
Clearly not. And finally, any life hacks?
I think the ultimate life hack today has to be around digital culture on our phones. Go and get yourself an app called Checky, which records how many times you open your phone every day. And it is frightening, and it will change you.
I've done it, Roman. It's so scary. It's horrible. A horrible app and a horrible experience, but it was brilliant while I had it on there. It's so scary. And what happened to me is, I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I had a back operation. And I talk about it a lot, Roman. But I was lying on the floor for 2 weeks afterwards, and I got bored of watching television. It's just after a while, it sort of got
even your own programs.
Even my own programs. Yeah, I'd watched my whole back catalogue. No, I got bored of doing that, and all the box sets. I got bored of films. I got bored of reading books after a while, just looking at the words. And I sat there. But the one thing which could continually attract me was my smartphone, where I could just keep refreshing. And I realised that I was just refreshing, refreshing, refreshing. And then I'm going to be really honest here. I haven't told anyone this really, but I had to keep on recharging my phone maybe once or twice a day. That's a full charge, because I was hammering it so much. And the addiction became so big. And it was a great thing in a way, because it became so powerful that I talked about this on the podcast a lot and talked about it with Mark. I had to do something about it, because it is an addiction, isn't it?
To be shocked. You need to have that moment of realizing, oh my God, I just checked my phone 178 times today, to think like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
Is this a way to live? Just think, you know, I'm sleeping for about 8 or 9 hours a day. I'm at work for another 8 or 9 hours. I've got about 4 or 5 hours left, and I'm using those, checking my phone. Yeah. I mean, what time is there left? What the hell is the point of being alive?
Yeah.
What, if you think of someone who died in a tragic car accident, or someone like your brother who died, you know, what they would give to have just one more day of existence. So what are we doing with our days of existence?
We're back to that death thing again, aren't we? There was that Australian nurse. I've heard about her a lot, and it's written in your book, isn't it? She interviewed people who were terminally ill.
Yeah, her name is Bronnie Ware, and she wrote this famous article called Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, and people who were in hospices, and said, well, you know, how would you live your life differently? And people said things, well, I wish I hadn't worked so much. I wish I'd really lived for myself rather than having done what people asked me to do or lived to their expectations. I wish I'd been more open emotionally with my friends and family, these kind of things. So I think it's worth thinking about, if you're on your deathbed, you know, how would you live, or how would you like to look back at your own life? Would you be happy to look back and think, okay, I was an unhappy lawyer for 37 years. I mean, how do you feel about that? Some people might be okay about it, but other people maybe not.
I know this, a man who worked in a hospice a lot, and I said, we were having a chat with him one day, and I was talking about my house and stuff, and it was various conversations. He started laughing, and I said, why is that? And he said, why are you laughing? And he said, no one on their deathbed, in his experience, and he'd seen quite a lot of people die, he says, ever talks about anything materialistic. They've only ever talked about relationships, and that's all that matters. They look back and they look at their relationships, whether it's people or pets or anything, which goes back to your talking to strangers, but communication with other humans is probably one of the most important things you can do.
Humans are the most social animal apart from the naked mole rat. You know, we actually care about other people, and if we're alone, stuck in a cell, we go mad.
Yeah.
You know, it's obvious that human beings need connection.
The mole rat, what?
The naked mole rat is this like little kind of rat, which they sort of cooperate together, and they're very, very social. They're an obscure species. Don't worry, you don't need to know anything about them.
You put in the conversation. I can't just leave it there. I'm going to have to start.
I thought that was quite a nice zoological reference.
It is, but now I'm going to have to spend the night Googling them. You've ruined me, Roman. Now, listen, mobile phone, to conclude this, yeah, the smartphone is an addiction. And at some stage, you've got to admit you've got it. That's the first thing, like any addiction. I recommend, by the way, grayscaling your phone. I read about it online. I've been doing it now for how many weeks, Mark? 3 or 4 weeks now. It means you don't go on your phone because it goes black and white and it's really boring. If you've got an iPhone, you just go into accessories and you grayscale it or look it up online. And that's what it is. Mark's just got me a picture to look at of the mole.
Naked mole rat?
Yeah.
They're pretty weird looking, aren't they?
They are very strange looking, yeah.
But we're all pretty weird looking up close.
Roman, thank you so much for doing the podcast. It's been a pleasure having you on. I'd like you to come back and talk more about love and some other subjects, because you know so much. Being a social philosopher lends you well to give us information on this podcast. If people want to contact you or they want to read more stuff from you, are you on social media?
Yeah, they can get me on Twitter at Roman Krznaric, RomanKrznaric, or website romankrznaric.com, or the website for the book is www.carpediem.click.
Right, .click. We'll put a link. Yeah, Mark just says there. We'll put a link on it for you. So thank you so much for coming in. And well, hopefully we'll get you back on. You can talk to us again soon.
It's been a privilege and a pleasure.
Thanks, Roman. So, Mark, that was interesting, wasn't it?
That's fantastic. Yeah. And I think I say the word fantastic after every one, but what I'm always really blown away by is, A, every person we've had on here has been such a nice person and a really nice person to be in the room with, but also the whole time I'm sitting there, they're making me think and think and think the whole time.
It's good, isn't
it? And I don't know how, I mean, I know you on telly, you just read an auto cue. But
that's all I do, yeah.
That's what everyone tells you anyway.
Yeah, that's all I do, yeah.
But here, when you're asking him, you're having to think of the next question, and all I'm doing is, you watch me sometimes, I'm looking at the cat or I'm looking out the window and I'm in deep thought the whole time. I love these interviews we do because they really make me think.
Yeah, I apologise for the bleeping always on these interviews, but as soon as we start doing one of these podcasts, the cat comes down and goes in and out of the cat flap, doesn't it? Every time. I don't know why.
And the other thing I was thinking as well is when he said, I go up to strangers and ask them what they want on their tombstone. I was thinking, what would I say? And then I thought...
Oh, go on.
No, it came a split second later. Leave me alone.
See, I told you.
I know, I said.
Yeah. And as we established before we did the interview with Roman, you're not very good at seizing the day.
God, I'd love it if we swore on this podcast.
You can swear.
All right, then.
No, don't. It's uncouth, and your mum listens sometimes. But are you more inclined to seize the day? I think his book is the summary of it is live your life. I think that's a really good summary. Yeah. Live it.
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest people go and have a look at it.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, have a read of it. But that's sort of what it is. It's go and live it. Are you going to seize the day more now? Do you think after that?
It'll seize you in a minute.
Are you? are you going to talk to a stranger on the train on the way home?
No, but
go on.
Get a slap. No.
Don't get violent. Your mum listens to this.
No, I said, I'll get a slap.
Oh, I see.
No, I do, but it's normally if I'm helping them, if they need help, or if someone asks me directions, or if they need their bag, you know, helping down the stairs or something, I'll do that. But I'm not just going to walk up to someone and just start talking to them.
Why?
I don't want to.
Hmm. I'm going to try it. Remind me.
You do all the time.
I know I do, but I'm going to... I don't... No, what happens is I'll be stood next to someone in a supermarket or something and I'll start talking to them. That's what I do. But I don't stroll up to someone willy-nilly and start talking to them. I think that would be a bit strange.
Right.
Don't you?
Yes.
Well, let's all try it. Everyone out there, try it and then let us know what happens. Write in and let us know. All right, that's it for this week's podcast. We'll be back next Monday, we hope. So we'll see you then.
Saves the day. Carpe diem. Bye.